KALW.
We got a raccoon coming off the top of the hill right here, and we've got one under the salt bush right over here.
Today we meet a man devoted to protecting the elusive gray fox and other animals that live along the bay.
And two of the longest standing died right in here. We lost 25 foxes to canine distemper.
The fox guy. Then we'll consider what can happen when certain species get more attention from conservationists than others.
That maybe everything had just a terrible year statewide. It was bad weather year for butterflies, particularly bad for monarchs.
And we'll hear about a climate change initiative with the goal to improve overall quality of life.
We know that the more trees you have, the less crime you have in the neighborhood. We know that.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Flying into the Bay Area, there's that moment before landing when it looks like you're actually about to touch down in the water of the bay. That area where land and sea come together is an estuary. And the San Francisco Bay Estuary is one of the most urbanized in the world. Almost 90% of the natural landscape along the bay has been lost to human development over the last 150 years. Climate change and sea level rise mean even more of it is going away. So what will happen to the hundreds of wildlife species that live there? Reporter Sophie Codner introduces us to a man known as the Fox Guy. He studies how foxes and other animals are surviving in shrinking habitat along the bay.
Okay. What time is it? All right, it's 5:10 a.m. I'm only half awake when I arrive at the address. A parking lot in Silicon Valley, surrounded by corporate buildings and warehouses.
So, let's head on down the road here.
I meet Bill Lycum, a sturdy 80-year-old man with long gray hair and a short white beard. It's chilly. The sun has yet to rise, and Bill wears a worn-in black jacket and matching cowboy hat.
So we're going to start here.
With just a few steps, we enter a marshland along the bay called the Baylands Nature Preserve. For over 10 years, Bill has navigated the area's dirt trails and tall, wet grasses every single morning before dawn.
Hold it. Wait. We got a camera right here.
Each day, Bill swaps out memory cards from his 11 trail cameras, which have been videoing the scene since nightfall. As he works, he surveys the wildlife.
We got a raccoon coming off the top of the hill right here, and we've got one under the salt bush right over here. Good morning. Mama. That's Mama.
Oh.
There's your first introduction to.
That was quick.
To the wildlife out here. There are no foxes on this side.
Bill is not a scientist by training, but with his cameras, he has produced one of the world's largest libraries of footage documenting the elusive gray fox. He's been called the Jane Goodall of the gray fox world. It's an obsession he comes by honestly.
When I was about 13 or 14 years old, I came upon my very first gray fox. My brother and I decided at that young age to trap the foxes.
Yeah.
We trapped quite a few of them, and then one of them got a broken leg. And that, I don't know, that just hit me hard. And I told my brother, I said, we're not going to trap anymore. I didn't think of foxes for a long time. I raised a family, went to college, did all kinds, you know, the regular routine things that people do.
50 years went by. Then one day in 2009, Bill was out birding in the Baylands.
I saw this fox sitting beside the road. It just was automatic. It just grabbed me. From that day on, I came back again and again and again, and finally stopped right back there in that gap. There were three foxes. And I said, whoa, I've discovered a family, not just one fox.
The gray fox is the oldest canine in the world, older than wolves, coyotes, and every other species in the dog family. They've been on Earth for 10 million years, and in the Bay Area far longer than any human. They're smaller than the better-known red fox, with hooked claws, a long pointed muzzle, and salt-and-pepper fur that turns orange at the shoulders and ears. There were more than 24 gray foxes in the area when Bill was reacquainted with them over a decade ago. By 2016, he was counting carcasses instead of foxes.
And two of the longest standing died right in here. That was Mama Bold and her mate Gray. We lost 25 foxes to canine distemper.
Canine distemper is a nasty viral disease. Here, it's a symptom of a bigger issue: lost habitat. Decades of urban development has cut up wildlife territory into small, overcrowded patches where disease spreads fast. It's a problem all around the Bay. City sprawl and busy roads trap animals so they can't move from one patch of habitat to the next. Over 100 local species are threatened or endangered, many because they've simply lost the space they need to survive. But Bill believes that cities can support wildlife with urban planning that keeps nature in mind. He wants to connect habitat patches to help animals navigate safely from the shore, through cities, and out to the spacious surrounding mountains. It's a goal of his nonprofit, the Urban Wildlife Research Project, to create what he calls the San Francisco Bay Area Wildlife Corridor. It would reach throughout the entire Bay Area and benefit all sorts of wildlife, including the gray fox. After the canine distemper die-out, Bill continued to tape the Baylands trails. For 2 years, not a single gray fox was spotted. The rodent population exploded.
Hey, little fox! Hey, Moss! Hey, guys! Hello!
In 2018, a new fox couple found their way into the Baylands. Bill named them Lamos and Big Eyes. Lamos runs up to us while Big Eyes hangs back in the brush.
Lamos means long neck in Greek. He's not as skittish as she is.
Wow.
There they are.
We duck under tree branches and move deeper into the woods. Bill calls the foxes bush dogs because they prefer shrub-covered territory.
This area is the heart of fox land.
Right now, it's home to just Lamos and Big Eyes.
And I'm thinking that there's something wrong in their reproductive system. Something is not right, because they should have had pups.
It's another sign of unhealthy habitat for the foxes, who disappear as soon as the sun peeks through the trees. Bill and I head back to the car, and he gets a bit philosophical.
The foxes are my professors, okay? They are the ones who have taught me, and I'm their student.
Hello.
A few months later, I caught up with Bill on video chat. I wanted to find out about a disturbing image of Big Eyes that he posted on his blog.
I was tagging all the images out of the camera, and when I came upon that particular one, I went, whoa, wait a minute, what's that? And I zoomed in to take a closer look at her eye. I have seen so much of that discharge from the eyes and canine distemper that it was just, oh my God, here's another one. Here we go again. I've learned something else about all of this, and that's how to let go. Although I get to know, you know, the foxes pretty well in terms of their personalities and so forth, there comes a point where you have to, well, when the young ones disperse, you know, they're there one day and they're gone the next, and you have no idea where they are. So you have to let go. So if Lamos and big eyes die, that's the way it is. I have to move on.
For Bill, moving on means focusing on preserving and connecting the remaining patches of habitat, which he says continue to be eaten away by the effects of climate change.
Rising sea level is going to push the wildlife deeper and deeper into the cities along the San Francisco Bay. And when that begins to happen, people in their backyards are going to begin to see more raccoons, more possums, more skunks, more foxes. What are they going to do?
After centuries of building and designing for humans, the Bay Area may soon have no choice but to plan for its wildlife too. Luckily, that could lead to greener, more livable cities for animals and people. From a marshland at the edge of the San Francisco Bay, I'm Sophie Codner for Cross Currents.
Sophie is a student at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. You can learn more about Bill's vision for a Bay Area wildlife corridor online. Go to KELW.org for more details. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. Adding to the list of sad news from 2020, the number of monarch butterflies in California has reached an all-time low. Scientists worry this Western insect species might go extinct. But in December, the Trump administration decided not to add them to the endangered species list. Western monarchs have been on the decline for years. Back in 2019, our science reporter Marissa Ortega Welch went out looking for the butterflies and learned that if we just focus on the monarch and not all the insects around us, we're missing the big picture.
I have this tradition of going to see the monarchs that spend the winter at Ardenwood Farm in Fremont. If you've never been, it's incredible.
It's like standing in a snow globe full of butterflies.
East Bay Park naturalist Christina Garcia is describing what it's like on a typical year. Hundreds, sometimes thousands of butterflies fly around you.
And you can actually hear their wings fluttering if it's quiet.
This year, like every year, Garcia started to look for the monarchs around October. She says their arrival is a nice sign that fall is coming.
So I'm always excited. So I'm coming out and looking, and it was pretty much a normal year.
About 150 showed up at first.
I kept expecting more to come. And then, as you'll probably remember, in late November, we had the horrible fires.
The campfire in Butte County.
The monarchs stuck around for like 4 or 5 days, and then one day they just disappeared.
And they didn't come back. Then, during the annual Thanksgiving monarch count,
we came out 3 or 4 times a week, just hoping to see them and find the cluster, and it just wasn't here.
Monarchs are found all over the U.S. On the East Coast, the monarchs actually had a good year. It's the number of West Coast monarchs that dropped this winter. Insect populations tend to fluctuate. You have to look at many years of data to see the trends. And for both Western and Eastern monarchs, it's been a downward trend since the 80s. What's making the news now is just how low the Western monarch numbers got this winter.
This is the first year that it's gone under 30,000 for California at the Thanksgiving count. And whether they'll be able to rebound again is questionable.
Nobody knows exactly what caused the numbers to plummet this year, but you can probably guess what's causing that downward trend overall. The usual suspects: habitat loss, pesticide use, climate change. Stuff that's going to affect other insects, not just the monarchs.
People have been counting the monarchs, and they haven't been counting other stuff as much.
This is Eric Simmons. He's an editor for Bay Nature, a local environmental science magazine. He says the monarchs are one of the few insects to have this statewide annual count. But what about other insects?
Maybe everything had just a terrible year statewide. We wouldn't know because nobody's been looking.
Globally, we're seeing headlines about the insect apocalypse. The truth is it's a lot more complicated. Those headlines draw on a study here, a study there, which tend to look at one species at a time. Charismatic species like monarchs or insects that have an economic impact like honeybees, you can't extrapolate about all insects from those specific studies, but the data they present paint a scary picture. And Simmons says the media likes to focus on that.
Like, we live in an age in which everything is going to be in crisis all the time. I mean, this is what climate change is doing to the world. And then when everything's always in crisis, it's just hopeless.
Simmons says you can find all kinds of butterflies in the Bay Area, some that are really common, some that are on the decline, and some that are rebounding after almost going extinct. And that's just one part of the insect world.
Like, hey, let's look at beetles. Like, there's so much to see and explore and pay attention to out there. And it just feels like it's so much more valuable and enriching personally to have that sort of sense of the whole than it is to just be jerked from crisis to crisis.
So Simmons wants you to get out and see stuff, not just the charismatic stuff.
Nobody has made up a California tradition out of a pilgrimage to Twin Peaks to see the Mission Blue.
Well, there actually is this one guy.
So here we are on a lovely morning, Twin Peaks in San Francisco.
I'm on a butterfly hunt with Liam O'Brien, a local lepidopterist and artist. Twin Peaks is the last remaining habitat in San Francisco for an endangered butterfly called the Mission Blue. If you make a pilgrimage up here in April around Earth Day, you can see them flying around.
You can't miss it. It's an electric blue little creature darting between all of these lupins.
We walk around to see what else we can find.
Hilltops become sort of the singles bar for butterflies.
O'Brien is a charismatic species himself. His niche is former Broadway actor turned fierce champion for butterflies, but not the monarchs. He feels like they have enough attention. O'Brien says people feel so emotional about these butterflies.
There's a lot of zealotry involved in wanting to help the monarch.
And sometimes they end up doing things that aren't actually that helpful, like planting milkweed, which monarch caterpillars depend on for food. But a lot of local gardeners plant tropical milkweed, a non-native species that has leaves year-round. The leaves trigger the adult butterflies to lay eggs in the winter during the wrong season.
What is next? We're going to see one of those hideous Sarah McLachlan commercials of imagine a world without the monarch. In the eyes of the monarch, you too can help save the monarch by sending us a check for $300.
O'Brien says environmental groups are kind of capitalizing on the monarch crisis right now, using it as a way to get people to donate. The best of these organizations use that money to restore habitats, fight climate change, and reduce pesticide use, efforts that could help many species. O'Brien says it's great if you want to donate to those organizations, but no nonprofit can really work to just save monarchs.
It's a charismatic creature that brings in a lot of money. It seems to be plummeting over the side of a cliff.
Without really big picture changes, it might be too late for some species.
These creatures, these mega charismatic things like polar bears, like panda bears, like monarchs, you know, you can't recreate an iceberg.
And if money isn't going to solve the problem, what can people do?
People need to just kind of calm down and let the experts figure something out.
It's going to take scientists a few more years of gathering data to see if the monarchs will continue their downward spiral or if they'll rebound. O'Brien wants people to slow down a bit and learn more before they jump into helping. He likes to paraphrase the famous biologist Jane Goodall. Only if we understand can we care. Only if we care can we help. Only if we help can they be saved.
But the problem with that quote is everyone skips the first sentence. Nobody really wants to work hard to understand.
Maybe the first part of understanding is just getting out and getting to know all the wildlife around us, not just the monarchs. From Twin Peaks, I'm Marissa Ortega Welch for Cross Currents.
Thanks, Marissa. That story was originally produced in 2019, and you can catch more of Marissa's science reporting at kalw.org. Thank you.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. Our last story today is about something that affects monarchs, gray foxes, all living species, climate change. And we've seen it manifest in devastating ways in 2020, wildfires in California, hurricanes on the East Coast. But there's a glimmer of hope in San Joaquin County. The city of Stockton recently made headway to tackle warming temperatures. It launched an initiative designed to help its most vulnerable residents. From our partners at Capital Public Radio, reporter Ezra David Romero has that story.
A few blocks away from downtown Stockton, there's an urban forest of about 40 trees. Sammy Nunez's nonprofit, Fathers and Families of San Joaquin, planted it. He says an investment in the environment is an investment in people.
The way we treat the land and disregard for the land is the way we treat families and children here in this community. And because of it, the land is hardened, the people are hardened.
Nunez says urban forests like this will be a big part of an $11 million state grant that Stockton received to combat climate change. He was part of a community process that helped map out the new initiative. He says this particular green space was created to remember victims of gun violence. Now it serves two purposes: cooling this neighborhood's heat island and paying homage to fallen family members.
This is about creating an opportunity for folks to heal and connect to the natural world and understand the value of these trees.
The hope is that there will be many more green spaces like this under the new Stockton Climate Initiative. The money will be used to make the city more walkable, less reliant on fossil fuels, and create more green space in vulnerable neighborhoods. Nunez wants the initiative to have long-term impacts.
We know that the design of a community in and of itself can actually be a deterrent to crime and violence. We know that the more trees you have, the less crime you have in the neighborhood. We know that.
Nunez walked me through downtown to show me how the grant may transform the cityscape.
So this is Census Tract 4.02 and 1.
The paved streets here may soon have bike lanes and tree-lined sidewalks. The grant will also help create more green jobs and increase household solar energy. Schools will have urban farming classes.
Climate change, the social political climate, has collided to create the perfect opportunity for us to really reimagine what it means to be a person of color in Stockton nowadays.
Stockton Mayor Michael Tubbs says the purpose of the grant is to ensure that all city residents benefit from the climate work. Even though his term ends in January, he wants to see the city become an oasis while it's climbing out of bankruptcy and still grappling with gun violence.
I want Stockton to be the community that shows what a Green New Deal looks like in terms of tangible benefits.
Stockton-based environmental advocate Barbara Barragan-Perea says planting trees in parts of the city where there are few will tangibly change residents' lives during heat waves.
It's already 10, 12 degrees warmer in South Stockton every year than in North Stockton.
However, she says the grant is just the beginning and doesn't address all the threats of climate change here. Algae in the Delta can harm humans and animals. Sea level rise would threaten community members who live behind levees. Back in the healing garden, a block away from the freeway, the sound of cars and big rigs pervade the air. I'm wrapping up the interview with Nunez, not because there's nothing left to talk about. It's just so hot. But before we go, Nunez has one more thing to say.
We represent every single demographic and market in the world here. If it works here, it could work anywhere. That's the good news. The bad news is the opposite. If it doesn't work here, it's not going to work anywhere.
Nunez could have left Stockton for a city with fewer problems, but he loves this place. When he looks at Stockton, he sees all the bad. But then what comes into view is hope.
That's Ezra David Romero, a reporter with our partners Capital Public Radio. You can find out more about Stockton's climate initiative at capradio.org. Today's Cross Currents team includes Scott Carroll and Lisa Ramreka. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shireen Adil. Managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Henat Baba.